Blog Talk Radio. Good evening. It's your madam. How are you?
Oh, fine. This is Rick Cornell.
Oh, Rick. I've got so much to talk to you about.
Oh, is this Becky?
No,
is this
Becky
or is this Madame Perry?
This is Madame. This is Madame Perry.
Ah, Madame. Yeah, seeing your Facebook post made me think I'm banned in Boston, condemned in Cleveland, and banished in Baltimore. I'm now taboo in Philly and St. Louis, and Chicago doesn't dig me anymore. I hadn't thought of that song in 50 years.
Whoa!
when it was popular. Anyway.
And I wasn't going to bring this up yet, but since you said that, since you led with that, counselor, I was going to say when – well, I'll get to it in just a moment. So for everybody else, welcome to Madame Perry Salon. I am Madame Perry. And that that wiseacre you just heard is attorney and author Rick Cornell, and entertainer too. That's what he is. So tonight it's going to be guess who Becky Kyle's bringing to dinner in Madame Perry's Salon. Guess what? Becky Kyle's not here.
She's
not feeling well. Yeah. I think she caught something from those. I think it's cat scratch fever.
From Becky, I'm sure it was.
And Carla's not going to make it tonight. I'm just pouring a little ginger ale here, a little cocktail. And you know who else is not going to make it? Carrie Dunn. But Carrie's father just passed away last week. I think the earlier part of the week, last week. And so he's still being with family. But we want to send out our love to his whole family. His father, Ray, passed, and I was fortunate to meet his parents at one of his book events in Baton Rouge when I was his publicist. So I met Ray and Adair and the family, lovely people. So Carrie and your mom, Adair, and your whole family, and your wife, Sheila, we're all thinking about you and holding good thoughts for you. Carla said she has some kind of a work thing at a temp job that she just resigned. But I don't know, with Carla's book, you know, this could be just some kind of a cover story. It could be. I don't know. I don't keep up with international intrigue as much as I used to when my husband was traveling the world. So, but Brett Wright will be in here later. Brett Wright, who wrote the book Nasty. And I have a few other folks that are going to drop in. So, but if you would like to tonight, if you're listening, and you would like to call in and talk with Brett Wright and Rick Cornell, please do. The number is 646-716-9922. And one of the treats that I was looking forward to tonight is that everybody's going to read something. And somebody, are you still with me, Rick? Have you left me?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good.
I am. You want me to read them? Do you want me to do that now?
Well, you don't have to do it now. You don't want to put your a show has to build, and you want to give them a little tease, but you don't want to give the whole thing away.
Well, that's kind of what I thought. Okay.
So I'm teasing them. I let them know that you will be reading, and so will Brett from something called Nasty. And my dear friend, Robert Leland Taylor. Don't know if you know him. Great writer. To me, his work is kind of very Kurt Vonnegut style. And his two books, Holy Toledo and the Virgin Shirley, and A Sunday Afternoon Stroll Through the Ant Farm. Love them both. So Rick, what kind of a week have you had so far?
Oh, what kind of a week? Tough trick question. humdrum, normal, nothing particularly good or bad. How about that?
I guess that'll do. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I know,
it
not very exciting.
Yeah, that's
it
about.
Could have been worse. That's right.
Working
on a habeas case where a guy stabbed his wife to death, and a child pornography case where a 70-year-old school psychologist was collecting pornographic pictures. You know, just the usual spate of sociopathy that I deal with on a weekly basis. Yeah.
Same old, same old. The same old, yeah.
Same old, same old. That's right.
Same old what did you say? Sociopathy?
Sociopathy, yes.
The usual miscreants, clochards, ne'er-do-wells, reprobates.
Reprobates, indeed, yes.
So tell us about your law practice, Rick. I'm really interested.
Well, my law practice goes like this. I was admitted to practice in 1979 in Nevada and 77 in California, and after clerking for a famous or infamous federal judge in Las Vegas for 2 years, I came up here. I was a prosecutor for about a year and a half, which is probably the greatest mismatch possible for career and person. Then I went into my own practice, and over time it evolved into an appellate and writ practice. I had tried about 30 jury trials between 1980 and 1997, but 97 was a year that I switched my practice, and there were two reasons why I did that. One was 97 was the year that I won probably my biggest win to date. I represented a serial sex slave murder in Nevada, and that was the year that I won his habeas corpus case in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And then it occurred to me that that's really where my practice needs to go. The second reason was that was the year that I joined Nevada Opera. And I learned a major truth that year, which is it's possible to sing opera and be an appeals and writs lawyer, but you can't sing opera and be a trial lawyer. I mean, when you're a trial lawyer, you owe your soul to the company store, so to speak, when you're in trial all the time, and it becomes all-consuming. But when you're doing appeals and writs, I had many an opera where I'd be backstage summarizing transcripts, and you know, the stage manager would say, okay, time to drop everything and get on stage. So I'd drop everything, go on stage, sing whatever I was supposed to sing, and then go back to the dressing room and continue to multitask. And it's possible to do that under those circumstances. So since 1997, I've been pretty much an appeals and writs lawyer and also an opera singer.
Wow. Okay. That's fantastic. So did you always sing from the time you were a kid, when you were young? Were you in chorus?
Yeah, well, really high school. What started it was when I was in high school, our high school did a production of The Music Man, as so many high schools throughout America will do. And if you remember that story, you have the school board that also doubles as a barbershop quartet. And I was cast as Ewart Dunlop, or the second tenor in the quartet, or use barbershop speak, I was the lead, you know, the guy who sings the melody. So that's really what got me going in singing. And actually, I did sing barbershop for, oh gosh, quite a while, about 10 years. And I'll say this about barbershop. A lot of people say, oh, that's such a corny form of entertainment. I won't agree or disagree, but what I will say is that you will not find a better avenue of singing for making you really, really acutely aware of pitch. You know, when you sing an A in barbershop, it better be 880 cycles per second, because if it's not, it's going to throw everybody off unless they happen to be off the same degree you are, you know. So it was really valuable in that regard.
Yeah, definitely there. That's quite a disciplined art.
It is. It is. I mean, what those guys go through on an amateur basis, I mean, the top-notch quartets, they rehearse four nights a week. The really, really good ones have gigs that, gosh, at least half the year. I mean, you are truly a professional amateur if you do that and you turn out to be really, really good at what you do.
So how often do you rehearse or get with the your opera group or perform?
Well, with the opera group, I understand there's two time frames here for me. 1997 to 2014 is one, and 2014 to the present is the other. And between 1997 and 2014, I sang in the Nevada Opera, which is based in Reno. And in their heyday, they would do three productions a year. And in a typical production, you would rehearse, two or three times a week for 6 weeks in order to learn the music. And then in the last 2 weeks, we had what I would call Opera Hell Fortnight, where every night you were doing something, staging rehearsals, tech rehearsals, dress rehearsals.
Oh, my.
And then the performance. And, it would become extremely time-intensive. In 2014, our company had a major upset. We went dark in 2013. The chorus at the end of 14 decided enough was enough and decided to split off from the Nevada Opera Company and form our own entity, which we did. We formed Sierra Music Society, Inc., DBA Popra, and I have been extremely actively involved in that since we started in November of 14. And it's been an education for me because not only is there a lot of performing that we do, but also I'm on the board of directors of the 501c3 corporation that runs the organization. And I'm learning a lot of stuff that I never knew about the trials and tribulations of forming a performing arts company like that and trying to raise money to make it work, to make it viable. So that's been interesting. And that organization now does, four dinner shows a year plus a Christmas show, so that's five, and then other concerts throughout the year. And it does scenes from opera, but it's really an eclectic mix. We sing just about anything. It's almost like the Boston Pops, you know. The Boston Pops was not a classical organization. Under Arthur Fiedler, it was John Williams was a very eclectic organization. We're kind of like that too. In fact, we do shows surrounded by a theme. We just did a show with the theme of Hollywood, and in this show, I sang a solo, and it was the song "Smile." Now, most everybody is familiar with that song, but what most people don't know is it was written by Charlie Chaplin, the movie star. He actually wrote the music, and it was for his movie Modern Times in 1936. People say, well, wait a minute, that was a silent film. How could he write the music? No, he wrote the music. He didn't write the lyrics. There were no lyrics in the film. Those were added later. Little piece of trivia I bet you didn't know.
That's pretty cool. That's good info. That's good trivia.
Yeah. So anyway, we do that, and the show before was themed on Masquerade, and I sang a Billie Holiday medley of The Masquerade Is Over and Good Morning Heartache. So, you know, we do scenes from opera, but we expanded into Broadway and jazz and pop and so forth. I mean, in The Masquerade Show, we did this very tight vocal jazz arrangement of Leon Russell's This Masquerade, you know, that was made popular by George Benson way back when, in the 70s.
Yeah.
So we do really a broad variety of music, and I enjoy doing that. So,
could you give me example of just tell me three songs that you really like singing, and then maybe some songs that you haven't done yet that you want to do?
Well, the next, okay, last year we did, well, first off, I really enjoyed singing Smile. I mean, that's a song, I'm amazed at how many people say, oh, that's my favorite song, you know. And I understand why. The lyrics are so direct to the heart, you know. They touch everybody. Last year we did a show themed on the 50s and 60s. And I channeled my inner Bobby Darin, if you will, and sang Mac the Knife, which is the most cheerful, upbeat song about a total sociopath ever written, except when you think about it, except the way Bobby Darin performed. I mean, except when you listen to the original recording by Brecken Wile with Lotta Lenya singing it, it was every bit as dreary as the song really suggests. Our next show that we're about to do is a show themed on cabaret. And although that would, you know, imply the musical cabaret, which we're doing, and cabaret type songs that Streisand, say, might sing, or Nancy Lamott might sing, or just to give examples, it also implies the Rat Pack. So my singing range is pretty similar to Sinatra's. I mean, I'm a bass baritone. I'm not going to say I sound like Sinatra, and I'm not going to go that far. Are you kidding me? But, you know, so many signature songs of Sinatra. I had to think about this one. I love doing one for my baby and one for the road, for example. Ooh. But I thought that for this show, the one that would best fit the theme would be another Tanner and Ebb song, and that would be New York, New York. The first show that we did was a Broadway-themed show, and my all-time favorite comedy or musical comedy is The Producers. And so, of course, I had to do Along Came the Alley for that one, you know. I had to channel Nathan Lane for that song, which was fun to do. But, you know, you can't do that song without the horny little old ladies who join in with you. Otherwise, the song doesn't quite work. So, if you can picture the scene in the movie, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Anyway.
Is it safe then to assume that you sing in Italian?
For opera, sure, because... Yeah. The lion's share of opera that we sing is in Italian. You know, Verdi's operas are in Italian, obviously, and then Verdi's one of the heavyweights in the opera field, as is Puccini. His operas are Italian. In Nevada opera days, we did not do Wagner operas, which are in German, for a very basic reason. A Wagnerian opera lasts about 4 hours. For a small regional opera company, which at its best has a budget of $1 million to put on three operas and paying union orchestral musicians, a Wagnerian opera would just kill you. I mean, you couldn't do it. So we never did, you know, Tristan and Isolde or much less the Ring Cycle. I mean, if you are into that, you're going to have to go to San Francisco or Seattle or Houston or Chicago or the Met, obviously, one of the well-heeled opera companies that has the financial ability to put an opera like that on. Your regional companies generally don't have the dough to do it. Anyway, yes.
All right. So what have you not sung yet that you would like to sing?
Well, the universe of possibilities is huge. you know, there's plenty of things. Well, for example, for the upcoming cabaret show, I mean, there are so many songs that Sinatra did and did so fantastically that would be lovely to sing. You know, wouldn't it be great to sing I Got You Under My Skin the way he did it, or Willow Weep for Me the way he did it? Of course, you'd kind of have to have Nelson Riddle or Billy May to really pull it off, or I Won't Dance, God, was there anything greater than Sinatra singing "I Won't Dance" with the Count Basie Orchestra behind him? Oh my God! But yeah, to do stuff like that would just be fantastic. But when we do these shows, you know, we have a course of about 20 or so, and our artistic director rightfully makes a decision: if you're going to do a solo, you're going to do one. We got to spread the wealth and give everybody a shot at this. So. Yeah, I mean, there are so many songs out there that could be done. When we did the Hollywood show, and I chose "Smile," my second choice is one that I would have loved to have done. One of my all-time favorite movie songs is "The Days of Wine and Roses," especially the way Tony Bennett did it with Bill Evans. That would have been fantastic to have done, but you know. Time is short, you know, you can only do so much. Yeah.
Right. Oh, you know what, Rick, I think my doorman's signaling me. I think somebody or a couple of people are outside. I hope they don't fall in that reprobate territory unless they've, you know, got some good stories and a good company. I don't know.
Yeah, if they're producing child porn, let's not talk about that
Yeah. Let's just kind of leave that off the... Although I did mark this show as explicit because somebody told me they were going to be, you know.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
GQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ,
see, my doorman's so dramatic. Intruder alert. Okay, it's not really an alert. Okay, so we got a couple of folks here. Come on into Madam Perry's salon. Find a nice big cushion to sit on.
Hello.
Who do I have here?
How are you?
Doing great.
Well, hi there.
Let me start off with Robert.
Yeah, how are you?
Robert, we were just talking about you. Robert Leland Taylor, author of Holy Toledo and the Virgin Shirley.
Is that Robert Leland Taylor?
I swear.
Is that Brett or is that Carrie?
This is Brett. Robert, how are you?
Hi, Brett. You know, I know all you people there, with the exception maybe of Rick. I don't think I've met Rick.
No, we've not met, but nice to meet you.
You too. I know all of you. I've known you for years, except I'm just now meeting Rick. If I saw you on the street, I'd know who you are by your faces. But, you know, if I heard your voice behind a curtain, I wouldn't have a clue. Of course, you know, I'd be a little creeped out, somebody hanging around behind my drapes.
Oh, man, and you found my hiding spot, too.
Yeah, I did. Is Carla there, too?
No, Carla didn't make it tonight. She's got some kind of a...
How about
allegedly
Becky?
She's working, but, you know, with Carla, it could just be a cover story.
Yeah.
That's what I secretly believe.
So Brett's
there. Yeah, I got
Brett. Carrie's there.
No Carrie.
No Carrie? Wow,
no.
you had three no-shows then.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least they call me. Carla had something come up. Yeah. Becky is sick. Carrie, well, you know, Carrie's father passed away about a little over a week ago.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's
that's too bad.
Yeah, and he said, you know, he's sick, plus he's still kind of down, you know, with the family, but...
No, I wouldn't imagine, no.
Yeah. And so, I've got Rick Cornell, Robert Leland Taylor, and Brett R. Wright.
IR.
Hi,
yes.
Brett. Good to hear from you again.
It's good.
Good to hear from you, too. Did I hear through the door here that you were talking about Frank Sinatra?
I was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, see, I was eavesdropping a little bit. Sorry about that. Must have borrowed one of Carla's listening devices. So,
Carla, yeah.
So I can take a seat just about anywhere here?
You know what I did? Maybe, you know what I did last night, speaking of Carla? My phone just finally just got on its... It was way past being ready to, you know, be put to sleep or have that last visit to the vet. And it's... So I had to break down and get a new phone. So I'm in there trying to get this little iPhone figured out. And while I'm waiting for my salesman, I go through every iPad there or every iPhone and subscribe to my podcast on it. And and not only that, but the one that you guys were on last time, Brett and Rick, I went ahead and also downloaded that too to play. So jumped up my numbers 352% by this morning because that way everybody coming through.
Oh my, that was devious and wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm a publicist, okay? And I'm always looking for the unusual.
352%, you say? I mean, don't tell me what the starting point was, but that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I thought it was a mistake when I saw the stats. I didn't think it'd be that much. But I was telling some of the salespeople there about you guys and what you do and the kind of books that you write. So.
Good. There I was never a big fan of Frank Sinatra until I was introduced to the song "The Summer Wind."
Oh,
and that song really.
Oh yeah, I'm familiar with the song. I don't think I've ever heard Sinatra sing it.
Evidently that was a pretty big hit for him, but I wasn't aware of it. You know, it's kind of obscure nowadays, but they say that was a pretty big hit for him.
Mm. Okay.
There was a movie where that was played almost throughout, but I forgot the name of it. It's with the Prince of Greenwich Village or something
Prince
like
died?
That.
The Pope of Greenwich Village?
Yeah, the Pope of Greenwich, yeah. And that was with
Mickey Rourke?
Yeah, and who was the other guy? The brother of the famous actress? What was his name?
Eric Roberts.
Anyway, there were a couple of New York thugs, and they were ne'er-do-wells. And they were, in one caper after another that went awry. And Frank Sinatra's "Summer Wind" played throughout, sort of a motif.
Yep, Eric Roberts, maybe.
Eric Roberts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Here you go.
That's who I was trying to think of. But that's a good old movie. I might have to print that again.
You know, maybe you will. I don't know. Have any of you read? Have any of you read Joe Queenan?
No.
I have not.
He did some.
No.
He's more of a essayist or a feature writer, or as he says, when any magazine needs a good hatchet job on somebody, I'm the man to call. but he has
the
one
Kitty Kelly of his day or something.
Exactly. Yes. And but he has one video where he's talking about he's going to go out in person. That he's going to go out and be Mickey Rourke for a day and just to go up to random people and. Subway or diners or such. So, now, Brett, you're going to read to us tonight, aren't you?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Okay. And, Taylor, if you've got something, you know I'd love for you to read it.
Well, you know what I could do? I have a play that is being published. I could read as a 21-year-old rural Kentucky girl. And give one of her little monologues, and I could do it in her voice.
Now you know the Kentucky accent that well.
I can do a Kentucky accent because I'm from Kentucky, but now the people in Kentucky make fun of me. Now they say that I don't sound like them anymore. But I'm sort of lost most of my Southern accent.
Okay,
but this is a 21-year-old girl who lives in rural. It's kind of a dystopian play, but it's being published.
Which is kind of what the elections turned into, a dystopian play. But enough of that. So with,
we can all agree on that much, however.
You know, when I go down the list of the trending news things on the side of Facebook, and today is something like John McCain cut one of his staff members because they were busted. Their meth lab was busted yesterday or the last week.
Oh, no.
For God's sake.
And all these things are real.
Wow.
This is like something Vonnegut or Robert Taylor would write. This stuff is.
Well, I'm writing that down as we speak. You know. I like titles. You know, I always think of a title first, and usually I like funny titles, and I always write an entire novel around a title. Now I'm thinking of. Julio and Juliet. a comedy, Julio and Juliet. I have no idea what it's going to be about, but I do like the title.
I like your other title, A Sunday Afternoon Stroll Through the Ant Farm.
Yeah, and then there was Sex Without Pliers.
That was no.
What's that like?
Sex Without Pliers. Well,
yeah,
it's the title's not germane at all. There is one mention of that by an insane lady in the play who does mention that she's got a big date and she forgot her pliers, but she's, you know, hallucinating, talking out of her head a lot, you know.
Oh, okay. I know where we were going back to, talking about you doing the play and the voice of the character. It's a young girl, a 21-year-old woman in Kentucky. And when I ask about your accent, because me being a native Atlantan, I'm always very sensitive to people who do Southern accents in movies that don't sound like anyone I've ever heard. And I remember seeing the movie about, I think it was John Lennon. Judah Friedlander played John Lennon. And I remember when I was watching it, he said, he's supposed to be Mark David Chapman. He played the guy that killed John Lennon, Mark David Chapman.
Right.
And he's sitting there and he's reading the words to Imagine, and he's going, Imagine there's no whatever. And he goes, that's easy for you to imagine because you got everything, you bastard. And I thought, okay, I don't remember what Mark David Chapman sounded like. He was he grew up near me, but he was a couple years younger, and he was in the same big, you know how they used to have the Boy Scout troops and then they'd have the big pack meetings?
Yeah.
And my mother remembers him from the pack meetings and stuff, but I don't. But I can tell you what, if he lived anywhere near Gresham Park in Atlanta, he did not sound like a riverboat gambler going, well, that's easy for you to say, you bastard, you didn't have any. It's like this guy could be rolling on the river playing cards with Red Butler. This is not
sort of
what
like
people
the Hollywood are. Southern accent, the Hollywood Southern accent, like, oh, I do declare, and all that, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think anybody in the history of the world has ever uttered those words. Maybe. I don't know.
Oh, I've never heard it, and I've lived in the South all my life.
Not since Scarlett O'Hara, that much we know.
Yeah,
that was it. I guess she owned that line, and after that, it was copyrighted, and nobody else in the South could say it. Maybe that's it. But yeah, but I remember, so that's always thinking, that's not what Chapman would sound like. But you're going to do your, but you're going to read. Who should, I think we're going to have, Rick's also going to sing tonight, but Brett, are you ready to read first from Nasty? This is a book. Wait. Okay, so if you're tuning in and you don't know, let me give you the little lowdown on Brett. Brett Wright, a retired U.S. Navy Chief Petty Officer. I think Carla Brady wrote this. I don't think any of this is true. Traveled the world extensively. Spent much of his time in the Pacific Northwest as well as Southern California when not abroad. And you're now a secondary English and social studies teacher, freelance journalist and author, married to his high school sweetheart, and she was the first person to publish your work, because that's very nice. And so you and your wife and youngest son kind of bounce around between Colorado Springs and Santa Fe, depending on when the rent's due.
That's about right.
I want Brett's bio. I like that.
Okay, we'll work you up one. So reading out this character you've written about, Nasty, the book is called Nasty, and it's about, I'm going to read the little blurb off of Amazon. It says, adultery pays, murder doesn't. See, I didn't know that. I thought it was the other way around. But adultery pays, murder doesn't. That is P.I. Nate Nasty Jepson's motto, and he normally makes his living snapping pictures of cheating spouses. When a stranger is brutally shot in the passenger seat of his car, he finds himself in the middle of a gang war between battling triads, as well as a suspect in the murder. Nate must step far outside his comfort zone to clear himself and live to catch another cheater. And by the way, I bought this today, and I bought your book too, Cornell.
Great. Oh, good. Thank you.
So,
I hope you bought the corrected version.
I do too. Because I got emails.
Well, supposedly the publisher ran a new run on it to correct some some typos that were in there that I certainly didn't introduce. And so I hope you've got that copy.
Well, so do I. So at least I'm forewarned, so I'll know it wasn't you. So would you read something from Nasty?
Absolutely. You know, I'm going to go ahead and just go with the opening, because I know Becky Kyle loved the opening of it. It's what first drew her to it. So this is from Nasty, and the chapter is called Sans Burrito, Sans Heartbeat. I'm Ignatius Jepson. I go by Nate. On the streets, they call me Nasty. Go figure. I don't like the nickname, but the weirdest things stick, right? It has to do with a transvestite named Bud, a porta potty, and a very public confrontation over some stolen payroll checks. Well, you can imagine, or maybe not. Anyway, I frequently wind up in a dirty parking lot, snapping pictures while hunkered down in the crinkly, dehydrated onion and dried mustard McSeats of my car. Usually, these photos are of lip locks and other body parts that shouldn't be engaged, at least not with each other. In a fair number of cases, I can't help but wonder why the skulls of the two people involved don't simply implode. Nature abhors a vacuum. I know that's cliche, but there it is. Private investigators have to strike the right balance of give and take, or they starve. Adultery, blackmail, embezzlement, those pay well. Murder doesn't. In most cases, we tend to get real intimate with the seedier aspects of society, no matter what the pay or who pays it. Some think that investigation is all about the forensic stuff you see on television, and it's test tubes and lasers and complicated science. And while that's true in some cases, most investigations are all about sweat, shoe leather, and pulling on threads to see where they unravel. There's also an awful lot of luck involved, more than you'd think. Fate seems to have something to do with it, too. From what I've seen, if you're not meant to find the answer to a case, you're just not going to. In the end, it all comes down to fate and luck. I tend to have a lot of luck, but fate pisses me off.
Yeah.
It doesn't care a whole lot about innocent bystanders. In fact, it stiff-arms them out of the way to get at whatever caught its attention in the first place. And I seem to get more than my fair share of the shoving, too. And frankly, I have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. It's my own fault, I guess. But that's a hard thing to remember when you're standing by the passenger door of your Subaru, inspecting a hole in the window and a corresponding hole in your passenger's head. It's even harder to remember when the other side of that hole is dripping down the side of your face. Blood cools quickly, and on that chilly night in the Pacific Northwest, it seemed like I was standing in an icebox, staring at the dead body of a virtual stranger. I tend to think most people have some goodness lurking inside, but on this particular night, that theory was hard to hang on to. With gore drying against my skin, my only real thought was, shit. Crisis tends to limit one's vocabulary. Colin Dunn pissed fate right off, apparently. It squished him with his index finger and wandered away, leaving me to clean up the mess. It was a pretty big mess, too. Typical. What was I supposed to do? Let it be? Stand there like an idiot with a body and wait for the police? Yeah, I guess that's what I was supposed to do, but I don't work like that. Besides, I decided right then and there that fate could just go straight to hell, and in hindsight, it was the best move I ever made. Mostly. Half an hour prior to that decision, I'd been on a rocky stretch of beach, looking out across the sound. The waning moon was a weak halo behind sheer clouds. It gave off enough light to see the wispy fog gathering on the shoreline. Morning was coming, but it was still a few hours off. By the looks of things, the day would go one of two ways. The sun would pop out for a moment and then get buried by the clouds, or the sun would decide it knew what was coming and just hide in a bleak cloak of dark clouds. It had a couple of hours to decide which it was going to do. I stood there hungry, a hint of salt in the air, just sort of breathing in and out while contemplating a path, a next step in the vague direction of my life. I liked that smidge of rocky shoreline just outside of Seattle. The city with all its lights and activity usually energizes me, but that tiny little hidden beach, that was the place where I went for heavy thinking. I usually had a burrito with me, though. That time, not so lucky. The taco shop I used to stop at was closed, a failed health inspection, thus sans burrito. So I guess I'll leave that there. Unless you want me to go on.
That's very nice.
Yeah. Modern day film noir. I love it.
Exactly. And you know, you have to realize, Taylor, we were laughing too. I think Rick was as well. Because the last time they were all here, somebody smuggled in a burrito here in the... Oh, and by the way, Robert Leland Taylor was the first person to compare the Madame Perry's salon to the inside of Jeannie's bottle.
Ah, genius.
Well, I'm glad you decided to adopt that.
Oh, yes. And everybody seems to agree with you. And then
that's the way I pictured it.
Yeah, so it. I think you said it smelled like...
Well, I think it's the cushions.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the problem. The cushions. Last time this bunch was here, somehow he found out that Brett Wright had smuggled in a burrito and was hiding it in the cushions.
Well, so you have
changed
all over.
We worked that motif. We worked that bit.
Or drink a fit, anyway.
That
so
was
interesting thing
though,
on
like
on that book. Interesting thing is my middle school, where I teach, carries my book, which is interesting when students come into class, because I teach social studies 7th grade right now, and students come into class and they'll say, "Mr. Wright, you said shit." I'm going, you know, it's not like you don't hear it in the hall. Come on now.
Exactly, or at home.
In 7th grade, I would think you'd hear things a little dicier than that, but anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Which brings
but they're
to
shocked,
mind
shocked I say. Pardon?
I know you recently had made a statement that you were going to teach these teacher students to be civil by example.
Yes.
How's that going?
It's going pretty well, actually. After the initial come to Jesus, so to speak, I said, we've got to start being kind to each other because there's a trend right now with social media and everything to break down that barrier of politeness and courtesy that's carried us through as a culture for so long. And now we're starting to act out in the same ways in real life as sometimes we do online. And that's not okay. And so we're starting with, defining respect, what does it look like in real life, giving them some assignments with, really how to do that, because I suspect some of these parents aren't actually teaching it, and if they are, the kids aren't getting it. And then how to deal with failure and disappointment and mindfulness even. We're looking at some meditation sort of things as well. And so far, so good. Administration found out I tend to get forgiveness before permission. I'm kind of one of those guys. But I told my principal after the fact that I was doing this, and he said, "Oh, yeah, great. Do you want me to come in and talk to you, talk to the kids?" And I said, not right now, but you're welcome to come in, And so, the principal and the administration is pretty solidly behind it now. And so we'll see where that goes. I just think that, some civility is actually kind of necessary now. I mean, not to put a damper on the interview or anything like that, but there's a lot of kids who are exposed to a lot of things on social media and a lot of feelings, they can't escape the bullying and things like that, and they choose to make, these ultimate decisions. And what I have told them, I said, that person's gone forever. They have no more decisions to make, but if you were the last person who talked to them and you were the reason why they did that, how are you going to live with yourself? And that just kind of silenced the room.
Yeah, definitely.
Brad, are you optimistic about this generation of students?
Actually, yeah. As far as native intelligence goes, and knowing their way around technology and their ability to write and all of that stuff, very optimistic. They're a bright, bright generation. The problem is comes in having them set their own limits, I believe.
Right.
You know, and by that I mean, you know, you can show them, you can model limits and that kind of stuff. You can do all of that stuff, but they have been raised in sort of this atmosphere where we can, you know, it's okay to do pretty much anything, and anything that is shocking is what you're kind of going for. And I'm not talking about all the kids, but, you know, a significant majority of them don't really know the social limits, the cultural limits that move civil society forward.
Right.
So I think that's the biggest problem with them right now. But as far as native intelligence and ability to solve problems, oh my gosh, these guys are just amazing. Amazing people. I think the future's going to be in good hands if we can train them.
Yeah. And Brett's working on it. He's taking his military background and he's working on it. I'm going to tell you about a couple of, but they'll never know because he's going to meditate them through it, so they'll never know. I'm going to take a few minutes just to tell you about some sponsors from Adam Perry Salon, and we love our sponsors very much, very good people. One is, and I've mentioned this one before, it's been on here, it's a guy named Mick Malley, and Mick has a podcast and a website. It's called Breakthroughs in Depression and Anxiety. Now, he's going to be the first one to tell you he's not a doctor, he's not a therapist, he's not trained, but he has suffered depression and anxiety, and he's made a point of researching everything he can find about future cures, natural treatments for anxiety and depression. So he has a website that, well, just go to the page at the website. It's called BreakthroughDepression.com. BreakthroughDepression.com. It's the same name as the video. So you can see it on the web, or you can also go to YouTube. He's got a channel there. But it's an excellent one. But, yeah, check him out there. Another thing is, another new sponsor, actually. Now, this sponsor, I put their the cover of their book on the slideshow here. They asked me to. And the book is called Venom Hustle. That's V-E-N-O-M, Venom Hustle, by Diallo Frazier. Let me read you about this. It says, imagine every vampire story you've ever read or watched on the big screen. Now, imagine all those on steroids. Venom Hustle is an epic series of stories that takes the reader through every emotion a human or a non-human can possibly have. Venom Hustle by Diallo Frazier, of 52 blocks fame, is sure to have you imagining images as dark and sinister as one can possibly have. And if you look at the picture, the cover of this book, the character on there, I don't want to say, you know, I don't want to say what he looks like. I don't want to use the old love child of metaphor, but you can definitely see in the family tree, I think I see Marilyn Manson and Bat Boy from the National Enquirer. But it's just a pretty scary combination.
Oh, my. And,
what was the name of the book again?
Venom, as in V-E-N-O-M, Hustle, H-U-S-T-L-E, by Diallo Frazier. And there was one blurb on the back of his book after read. It says, Diallo Frazier is at his absolute best in this creative book that is a perfect combination of supernatural instinct, imagination, creativity, ambition, and will to survive. He reminds the world why the revitalization of fiction books can have such a mind-opening impact on the reader. This is a must-read. And that blurb for the book was done by Grammy Award winner Ludacris.
Hmm.
Wow. You know, you nailed that cover. I'm on Amazon right now looking at that, and you totally nailed that for the description. Absolutely. Bat Boy and meets Marilyn Manson. Oh, my God. That's amazing.
No, they've got to both be in this critter's family tree. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Yeah. So that's one. And one more I need to tell you about is, and this is somebody we mentioned last week, but Brett DeHoag, and it's spelled B-R-E-T-T-D-E-H-O-A-G. Brett DeHoag is a motivational and inspiration coach. He's got a website called brettdehogue.com. He wants you to learn how to live with adventure. And he will give anybody who's listening tonight to Madame Perry Salon, just go on that site, and there's a link to getting one free 30-minute session with him. So it's motivational and inspirational coaching from Brett DeHogue. Yeah, go on the website and get your free session. Of course, as for me, I have these guys for my inspiration. I have Rick Cornell, Robert Leland Taylor, and Brett R. Wright. Now, Mr. Cornell.
You should write little jingles
yes, ma'am.
For your products.
I should what?
Write little jingles for your products that you sponsor.
You think I should? Okay.
Yeah, have a little jingle playing in the background. No, at the end of the presentation, you can have a little summary, you know, with a little jingle.
Okay,
I'm kidding. You don't have to do that, Jennifer.
No,
I'm
let me
just
tell you.
Kidding.
No, let me. I'm not going to do it now. Don't worry. Don't worry that you're going to get raw material here. But I got to tell you this. There were a few times in the past when for sponsors I would do it. If you've ever listened to, and they have a channel on XM, Sirius XM, Turn Back the Dial Radio, Radio Classics, and they've had like these old shows, and especially like things like Jack Benny or whatever, they'll incorporate the commercial into the script where somebody, you know, knocks on the door, you know, oh, Mary, open the door, and it's, hi, have you tried Johnson Wax? And they'll slam the door in the guy's face, he knocks it again. Johnson Wax can make your floor shine. Get that guy out of here. So there were a few times when I think especially when Becky Kyle called in, I would give her the script ahead of time, her and a couple of other friends, and we would make up a script for the sponsor and do it like that. You know, this Becky going, say, did you say glamping? Or, you know, whatever. You don't mean so-and-so, do you? Yeah. We could do that. Say, did you know that book was called Nasty? Why, yes, it was. Ooh. Nasty. So something like that. Yeah, we've got to do it. Now, Rick Cornell, you're going to give us a double threat tonight. You're going to read, and if I'm still lucky enough, you're going to sing for us, too. So.
Yeah, okay, I'll do that. Which would you like me to do first?
Why don't you
read?
Gosh. Yeah.
Okay. This is from my novel that's all of 5 months old called 2051. The gist of this novel is that America suffers its greatest act of domestic terrorism on 8/31 or August 31, 2049, and under the law hastily passed by Congress in response to the public outrage, an American who engages in the ultimate act of kindness and Christian charity can end up in prison for life for treason, and that happens to Bo Brown, the supposed protagonist, who's a kind, helpful son from my first novel and is a congregational pastor nearing retirement. So he's been charged with treason, and he's going to trial. And I think everybody who's read this book and commented on it agrees that the best part of this book is the trial itself. And it starts off by introducing my favorite character in this book, who is Ana Katic. She is Serbian. So here we go. This is the beginning of chapter 14. At the beginning of jury selection, Judge Hickson directed the clerk to direct the prospective jurors to raise their collective right hands and swear that they would answer the questions posed completely honestly and accurately. All of the veneer except one raised his or her right hand before saying, "I do." The clerk noticed the omission and immediately advised Judge Hickson, "Your Honor, potential juror number 25 has not raised her right hand." Potential juror number 25 was a native Serbian, emigrated to and naturalized in America with the anglicized name of Ana Katic. Antonio Chet Atkinson, who was the prosecutor, Esperanza Lopez, who was the lead defense counsel, and Judge Hickson took one look at her, and each became instantly captivated. She had that effect upon a lot of straight men and gay women. Ana Katic was about 30 years old, 5'7" tall, about 120 pounds, with long black hair, full lips, large breasts, an hourglass figure with long legs and dark, piercing eyes. Judge Hickson stated, "Ms. Katic, when the clerk asked you to raise your right hand and take the oath, you refused. Why?" Anna looked at the surly old man with those Eastern European eyes and responded, "Your Honor, your question assumes that I am a liar by nature, but if I put my hand on some book of yours, that somehow I am magically changed into one who can only tell the truth. I don't believe that. I believe in God, but I also believe that I was born and raised by my family to tell the truth always. I don't need to pretend to believe in God in order to tell the truth. If I tell you something outside of this courtroom, it's the truth. If I tell you something inside of this courtroom, it's the truth. Nothing changes. Raising my right hand doesn't change a lie into the truth, and raising my left hand doesn't change a lie into the truth either." Hickson said, "Counsel, approach the bench." Atkinson, Antonio, and Esperanza did so. Hickson leaned over. "Not only am I not striking this juror from the panel, but if any of you challenge her, I'll hold you in contempt of court." That was the only time during the trial that the judge and all three lawyers laughed out loud at the same time.
Very nice.
I like that. I like that. And what's the name of the book again?
2051. And that scene, by the way, is borrowed from the telling in Reno of a similar thing that happened in front of the judge who I think was Reno's greatest judge, Bruce Thompson, after whom our federal courthouse is named, and his actual responses. "I find this juror to be the most truthful juror this court has seen in 35 years. You're staying."
Okay, and so you said 2051 has the same character, Ryan Brown, from...
This is set 36 years into the future Ryan Brown. And Bo Brown is his son, who had a small role in my first novel, I Am That Fool. And Bo is the ostensible protagonist, but really as you get into the story, you realize that Bo's nephew, the one who ends up being the actual lead lawyer, Antonio Lopez Brown, later Antonio Katich, Brown Katich, is really the protagonist.
Oh, okay.
You say your book's been out for 5 months, Rick?
Yes, yeah, it came out late November.
Okay, so it's available at Amazon?
It sure is, you bet.
Okay. Have to check that out.
You know, I like the, when I was also reading the blurb on Amazon, or copying that for your book, I Am That Fool. I when I was just reading the first parts of it, Rick.
Yeah.
It says Ryan Brown, this is on the blurb rather, because I haven't started the book yet, even though I've got it. Ryan Brown, the most successful trial lawyer in his state, purposely unnamed, celebrates a big win in the Tory strip club, the Proud Stallion. There he meets a stripper, Celeste Loire. And on his way with Celeste to have sex while driving drunk, he crashes his car. And you know what I thought of? Fanny Fox and Wilbur Mills.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Oh.
The title based on bombshell.
For those of us who are around in the 70s, oh, yes. Except I picture Ryan being a little bit better looking than Wilbur Mills.
Oh, gosh,
and
yeah,
not quite as powerful.
No, not as powerful, but definitely better looking. And
I've
read Nasty, too, and enjoyed it very much. As a matter of fact, I think I wrote a review for it a few years ago.
Yeah, I think you did. And thank you so much for reading it, and your comments are too kind.
Thank you very much. I never lie. Whether I have my left hand up or my right hand, I never lie.
Never. All right. So have we reached that magic moment, that magic point in the show when Rick Cornell... going to serenade.
Yeah, I guess so. I had mentioned before
Don't push you into it.
Oh, no, I'll do it. How could I resist? I had mentioned to you, Madam Carey, before Brett and Robert came in that we had just done a show themed on Hollywood, where I sang the song Smile, which I have discovered since doing it seems to be everybody's favorite song. And I understand why, you know. Such great lyrics, and as I mentioned to you before, the music was actually written by the movie's star, Charlie Chaplin. And you say, how can a movie star write a song for a silent movie, which Modern Times was? And the answer is, well, he wrote the music. Someone else later added the lyrics, and it goes something like this. Smile though your heart is aching. Smile even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you can buy if you smile through your fears and sorrows. Smile and maybe tomorrow you'll see the sun come shining through for you. Light up your face with gladness, hide every trace of sadness. Although a tear may be ever so near, that's the time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just smile.
Hey, that was
okay.
Great. That brings
Thank
me back.
You.
That reminds me of my childhood, the Nat King Cole's version of that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, there have been so many great versions of that song. I'll tell you
yeah.
what. You want to hear a version that'll knock your socks off? It's Jermaine Jackson singing it at Michael Jackson's funeral. It's on YouTube. It was Michael Jackson's favorite song. So can you imagine
really
being Michael Jackson's brother and singing that at his funeral? Yeah, unbelievable.
Wow. That's surprising that a song like that would be Michael Jackson's favorite.
Mm-hmm. It is until you think about the song and the lyrics and what the message is, and you think about what a tortured soul Michael Jackson was, and then, you know,
right.
it makes perfect sense when you think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, lyrics-wise, I guess he could relate.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was beautiful, Rick.
Yeah.
Thank
good
you.
Good job.
You took us out to the very, even to the very, very, very last bit. Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
That and
was
we
amazing.
Have had Rick Cornell. I know. It's such a beautiful voice. Can't wait to see you live sometime. Thank you so very much. I'm so honored that you would do this.
Well, thank you for asking me to sing something. You know, most people who hear that say, oh, that's very nice and interesting, but they'd rather not test fate and hear what I actually sound like.
I thought it was nice.
In
that was
a community
that was
choir.
Without...
How interesting.
Oh, gosh, I know. Well, you know, yeah. It's, it was just beautiful, just so beautiful. All right, Mr. Taylor.
Yes.
You're up.
Oh, okay, mine's very short, and feel free to laugh if you get the urge, because just picture me in a 50s-style dress standing before the audience. And this opens.
You know,
the
I've
play.
Done that before, though.
You must send pics. Anyway, she's standing on the set. She's standing downstage, and her mother and her father are eating at the dinner table in the background as she speaks. Of course, they're oblivious that she's talking to the audience. And Eileen is 21 years old, and here she is. This is the house we lived in. What I remember most about it, I think, are the big wallpaper roses. Mama had this thing about roses. She always hung the paper herself, too, on account of Daddy's back. Sometimes, when I was little, I'd sit and count those roses over and over. And each time I did, the count was never the same. I could never figure out why. Civilization of sorts is about a half mile down the road. Every Tuesday and Thursday, I walk to Franklin Elementary to teach the slower kids how to read and write, among other things. Sometimes their parents would come along, and I'd teach them, too. When it was cold or raining, Daddy would drive me in his old truck, but it had to be below zero, or there had to be lightning, or I walked. Daddy had this thing about lightning. Although he never talked about it, I sometimes wondered if he was once struck during a storm. She crosses towards the table. They say lightning never strikes in the same place twice. She looks at her father. Perhaps they're wrong. At least I like to think they are. That's it.
That's great.
And then they all join in conversation at the table.
Oh,
I love that. That's,
how do you
yeah,
know?
And
me too.
And that is Sex Without Fires?
That's what?
What is that? That's Sex Without Fires?
No. That's Kentucky Winks.
Kentucky Winks. Okay, and that's the one
Kentucky
that won
Winks.
The.
Yeah, that one won the Southern Playwrights competition. A long time ago. Actually, it was like I think it was 2003, and. It was dormant for a long time, and I just, you know, brought it back out and started resubmitting all over again, and I found a publisher that is going to go be presented to, you know, theaters for licensing May the 29th. Hopefully I can, you know, get a theater or two interested, you know, make a few bucks off of it. That would be great.
I think it can, and I mean, after all, if Atlas can shrug, why can't Kentucky wink, right?
Oh,
that's right,
yeah.
That's right.
Well, Taylor.
Well, and Robert, I just wanted to say, I did read Holy Toledo and the Virgin Shirley here. I think it was last year because I post what I'm reading up in my classroom window so that everybody in the hall who passes. So I'm currently reading, you know, whatever. And when I posted Holy Toledo and the Virgin Shirley on there, one of the kids came by and said, "Mr. Wright, are you sure that's appropriate?" And I said, "Yeah, probably not." It was an excellent read.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Well,
it was fun to write.
You're as much as a playwright as an author, aren't you? I mean, you've written plays before, and you've worked
in
theater.
I alternate back and forth. You know, I should focus on in one area, you know. But I like both, and I'll get on a novel kick for a number of years, and then I'll get an idea for a play, and then I'll be, you know, catapulted back to plays. But I enjoy them both equally. And I enjoy acting as well, but I haven't been doing much of that lately because, you know, I'm getting up there in years, and, you know, all the parts that I used to get aren't available these days, you know. I've lost my mojo, among other things.
And what kind of parts did you play?
Well, I used to like to do the comedies. I liked a lot of the comedies, and I've done some that I've written myself here in Zanesville, and there was one in there was a couple in a small theater in New York City called Don't Tell Mamas.
Well, I've been there, yeah.
Have you really?
Uh-huh.
Oh, that they did Sex
Very
Without
famous.
Fires there. By the name of Donna Cacinello, did that in New York, and that was my first visit to New York. Actually, I had my daughter drive me because I was too intimidated by the trip.
Really?
It was just overwhelming for me. Just the idea of going to New York overwhelmed me. So I said, "Hey, Carolyn, you want to go to New York City?" And she said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay, you're driving." She said, "Oh. Okay." But it was a fun trip.
You think it's intimidating, but it's really not. once you get there, because I've spent so much time.
Yeah, once you're there a couple of times, you know, you get used to it, and it's, you always think about, you know, the worst parts, of the rumors and everything about being mugged on the corners and everything, but I was pleasantly surprised. You know, the people there were very friendly.
Yeah, I was afraid people would laugh at the way I spoke, so I didn't want to talk, and then somebody said, oh, no, you probably heard that women, we're very, very nice people, and that's true. And it's like the first time I sang somewhere in New York, I remember they read off of my business card. At the time, I had an address in Tucker, Georgia. And they go, hey, we got a singer here from Tucker, Georgia. And I thought, oh, great. I can see I just expected everybody just to kind of go, oh, no. But they did not. And they were very nice. And they were very welcoming. And then later that night, that's when I was doing some work with Anita O'Day. And came out of a gig of hers at 2:30 a.m. And somebody walked down the street there at Lafayette and Great Jones and said, weren't you singing at Primi Della Rossi today? And another guy said, okay, does your husband know somebody can walk down the street at 2:30 a.m. in New York and recognize you? And I said, this is that one tiny moment in the universe that would happen. And no, my husband would not be surprised. But no, that was the only time. And it probably never happen again. But it's that one little moment.
That's the way it always seems to go. I think Grant, you know, Grant Jerkins, he's from Georgia, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you had him on your show ever?
No, I would love to. I would love to. I wanted him back when Madame Perry Salon was just a blog. I think I interviewed him, and you co-interviewed with me. Do you remember that?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'd like to have him on here live. I'm a big fan of Graham's, and the story he had about Eula Mae Shook, that was good.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's a great name, if nothing else.
It is. It's a great name. It's just a short, I don't know, it's like between a short story. Yes, it's just a good short story, and it is good. Eula Mae Shook.
I enjoyed that one, too.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of the road?
Yeah, I think I've got all his books, as a matter of fact. He's got Done in One, At the End of the Road, A Very Simple Crime.
All right, so what else have you guys got coming up? Oh, I'm sorry, you were...
No, I'm done.
No. Brett Wright, because I know you guys got to go home. I know that Rick has got to, prepare some appellate briefs or something and also get his lucky underwear for the next singing gig he's got, which, by the way...
Where is that lucky underwear, anyway?
Where is that dang lucky underwear? Fanny Fox. On her trophy wall, or whoever would be the equivalent today. Have you ever seen and this is not meant as a joker or a have you ever seen on Jimmy Fallon when they have a barbershop quartet on?
No, I haven't. I can only imagine. Actually, he's so talented, I could see him singing with him, but no, I've not seen
him. He is a talented man. And no, so they have a barbershop quartet that comes on occasionally, and they'll have somebody else on. Like one night it's him and his buddy, Justin Timberlake. So the two of them join an actual, it is a, obviously a bona fide barbershop quartet. Come on, and with these two guys, they'll do some songs like, Blurred Lines or something. I don't know.
Blurred Lines done in barbershop. That's
or
funny.
It'll be some kind of a modern, song, and they'll do their take on it. It's hilarious and well done.
I bet.
So what's next for you, Rick Cornell?
Oh, gosh. As far as writing goes, I have now started the creative process for writing my third novel, which is going to be entitled La Raza para Justicia, Spanish for The Race for Justice. And this is going to be loosely based on a case I handled. We talked about this last time, I know, or I did. A case that I handled where an innocent guy, an innocent Latino who was nevertheless believed to be a leader of a gang, went through three trials in my habeas case, spending 11 and a half years of the toughest years of custody imaginable for a murder he did not commit. But, he really didn't. And the state star witness did and got a free pass for it. And the first time the jury convicted. I had the longest habeas hearing in Washoe County history, anyway, maybe Nevada history, where the judge granted habeas. He then had two trials after that, where the first one the jury hung 9-3 for conviction, and the second one they hung 8-4 for conviction, before finally common sense prevailed and they gave him a deal for time served. But to me, the whole case really struck a chord, saying there's got to be a novel in this story. So I'm writing a story that's very, very loosely based on it. And, you know, the first thing I figured I got to do is buy a copy of Gustavo Arellano's great book, Ask a Mexican, and get hip to Mexican lingo, because I want to write this book in a way that connects with both Latinos and whites, or whoever would read it, really.
Are you writing this in Spanish, Rick?
I will write it in Spanglish, you know, in parts of it, in the scenes that involve, you know, like the very first scene that involves the actual murder. I thought about this and thought about, you know, this could be the retelling of To Kill a Mockingbird with the Hispanic culture 50 or 60 years later, except that story was told very much from you know, the white version with the saintly Atticus Finch. And I'm thinking, I don't want to write it like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make it more multicultural. But same idea, you know, with the To Kill a Mockingbird. Show me a Negro in the 50s in the Deep South who's accused of raping a white woman, and I'll show you someone who's going to prison for the rest of his life, regardless of what the evidence is. To me, this is kind of the same thing. Show me a young Latino male who's accused of murder in a gang situation, and I'll show you someone who's going to prison for the rest of his life, whether he's innocent or not. I mean, to me, it's kind of the same thing, and I think it's a novel that really needs to be written. So,
yeah.
I'm going to start on that. If nothing else, I have created a challenge for myself. But you know, I did that with 2051, where my main characters are two lesbians in a gay marriage, and their son. Their only child is the son, Antonio, who becomes the lawyer. I mean, what does that family unit look like, particularly when one of the women is an abuser? Okay. I mean, you know, that's what we do, right? We create challenges for ourselves and let our imaginations and our research go as far as we can take them. So
yeah.
That's what I'm doing writing-wise. So.
All right. And please... Please keep us up to date on this, Rick.
Okay.
We really want to follow this and get this and read this. So please, yeah, let us know.
Will do.
Thank you. Robert Taylor, what's next for you?
Well, I have the play Kentucky Wings going public on May the 29th, the Actors Edition playbook is going to be available. And also the play is going to be available for licensing, you know, by theaters. I'm currently writing a novel called Farewell Daddy Bones. And I've been working on that off and on for several years. And I keep going back to it. It's one of those long-term things. I think the same thing happened to me with Holy Toledo and The Virgin Shirley. I started that thing as a play years ago, and then I stuck it in a drawer and just gathered dust, and then I dusted it off and decided to go ahead and make a novel out of it. But I tend to do things like that, you know, just put them away for a long time and then start on something else. But so I'm writing Farewell Daddy Bones. I'll be having Kentucky Wings published on May 29th. And I have my finger poised over publish on Amazon for a Sunday stroll through the ant farm, but I just can't bring myself to do it. It's ready to go, but I'm still looking for a publisher, and hopefully I can get it published by a traditional publisher. So I'm still working on that, too.
Well, I don't blame you. Mr. B. Brett R. Wright.
Yes, I'm.
What's coming up?
What's coming up? Well,
I put out a message to Laurel to ask, you know, your lovely wife, to ask her if she was listening. So don't know if I should ask you from her point of view or yours, but what's coming up with you?
Oh, you know, she is under a deadline at work, so she's downstairs frantically putting together spreadsheets and all that other interesting stuff. But yeah. I use spreadsheet and interesting in the same line. That's
I know.
Not something I usually do.
You guys are so clever.
So what's coming up next is Nasty People. That's the kind of a sequel to Nasty.
All right.
And yeah, it will not be available in the middle school. It's a little bit darker. it deals with human trafficking, and so that was kind of a struggle to maintain a level of humor with that and still treat the topic with some respect, you know. And so that took a little bit of time to write and to kind of get the timing down on when it's, you know, when is it okay to throw off a one-liner and when do we just need to just kind of play it straight. So that was kind of a challenge with that book. And so it's in final rewrites. Cover art is, I'm assuming, is coming in from whoever the publisher gets her cover art from. And I know one of the people working on it is a friend of ours, Jeff Fielder, and I'd like to put a plug in for him. Wonderful graphic artist. In fact, he designed the cover for Nasty, and so he's working, and I can't wait to see what he's come up with, and I hope that it's something that we can use again. That would be really
Jeff
nice.
Jeff Fielder.
So, yeah.
That's a great
Jeff
cover.
Fielder. Yeah. And
yeah, he does great.
He does.
And by the way, Brett, I got to tell you, I love the way you put, and you did this last time, you put an image out there of you in the studio, on the show. I love you for doing that. I really do.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I love the way you do that. It's so good. It just brings it real to the people. You know what I'm saying? And somebody else, I don't know, I think that the lights are a little dim in here, and I don't know if it's somebody just came in to bring you a burrito or to take yours out. But somebody else slipped in the door here. Hey, this is Madam Perry.
Hello. This is
hello.
Boomer.
Boomer Brummer?
I just want to say something right now. Okay, I heard the Barbershop Quartet. My eyes lit up. I heard Jimmy Fallon. My eyes lit up even bigger. Here's the thing you got to listen for, okay? Ignition by R. Kelly. Look for it on YouTube. They do a beautiful rendition of it.
Okay, I have not heard that one yet. Because what I did just post, and I made this to your attention or tagged you, Rick, was the Sexy Back with the Barbershop Quartet. Oh, they're called the Ragtime Gal. Yeah.
So, I mean,
one, Boomer?
It's called Ignition by R. Kelly. That's the song. But Jimmy Fallon and his Barbershop Quartet does a beautiful rendition of it.
Hmm. Oh, okay. I was confused there for a second. All right, I got it now.
Yeah.
But in other words,
R. Kelly is not singing this. It's Jimmy Fallon and his Barbershop Quartet.
Jimmy Fallon on his show does the R. Kelly song, Ignition. And when I heard it, I'm like, no, that can't be right. And then you finally hear it, and it's like, well, they made it sound better. They did. They made it sound better than what it was.
Yeah, some of these quartets are capable of doing that. I go back a long way, but I can remember a quartet from Whittier, California, that did a version of Sending the Clowns that just blew every other version, Sending the Clowns off the map, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, some of these guys are just amazingly talented.
And I tell you what, and it's not just the Barbershop Quartet anymore. The biggest thing out right now on television is the lip syncing battles, where, you know, they're not singing or anything like that. It's just the movements and the actions that they go through, and the stage production of something that they're only supposed to do a minute and a half of. because of television. But, you know, I just heard the Barbershop Quartet and Jimmy Fallon, and I'm like, oh, I got to call in.
Oh, good.
I was going to call in anyways, but that was that put it over the top.
Okay. I'm glad. And by the way, you guys, this is Larry Boober Brumley, and he's a good friend of the show and sometimes a sponsor with his Common Pocket Player Network. And you obviously by now you know Robert Leland Taylor, Brett Wright.
Right.
Rick Cornell.
Hey. I've been listening every week now.
Oh,
you
good.
Got me hooked, girl. You got me hooked.
All right. That's what I like, baby. That's what I like. So I guess I need to wind up now so you guys can have can get on to your whatever it is you do out there that I don't need to know about.
Yeah, it's almost 6 o'clock my time. It's time for burrito.
I don't
want to
know.
Burrito.
Well,
the burrito is only part of the whole scenario.
It's always going to be. It happened last time, Larry. I don't know if you were listening that time, but it happened last time. And, we had to call in the cleaners and everything. But you know what? For a good company like this, it's worth it. It's worth it. And by the way, it was Brett, not Rick, that did that. But.
Yeah. What, who, me?
But I don't want to know what you guys are doing.
I'm
afterwards.
Watching the program right now, and it says explicit, what? And I thought this was rated G. Oh, never mind.
Oh, no. Well, they said no. Or so.
It was nice to hear your voice for the first time, and Rick, it was very nice meeting you.
Yes, likewise. I enjoyed it a lot.
That was really fun. We should again try to get together and do that again.
Yeah, hopefully Becky.
You should
make it
an hour later, and we can have drinks.
We love you, Becky. We love you, Carlo, and we love you, Carrie. And we should have been here, but we'll just have to do it again with Robert and Brett and Rick and Boomer. And you know what? As I was saying earlier, I don't want to know what you do because, as my good friend and trusted advisor, Rick Cornell, tells me, what I don't know, I cannot be subpoenaed to testify about.
Yeah, you would just have nightmares.
That's my advice, and I'm sticking to it.
He is. He's sticking to it completely.
You,
me
you
and Fanny Fox, we're not doing anything. And, and also, if you're out there, if you're a musician, or an author, and you want to get your music out further, and you want to get your books out to more people, but you can't hire a publicist, remember, I have a webinar called Promote This, DIY Publicity for Authors, and I have one for musicians, too. And you can just go to my website, Lone Wolf Communications, LLC. My theme music, Missy's Vacation, is composed and performed by Denton Perry. And you can follow all of my guests and all the wonderful people I have. Do I know the coolest people or what?
Sounds
anybody
like you do.
Bueller?
You do.
I think as Shakespeare said, I'm wealthy in my friends. So let's break it down. We've had a great time here tonight. My friend Boomer Brumley came in. Also, Robert Leland Taylor, Brett R. Wright, Rick Cornell. Rick, I look forward to possibly, hopefully, doing a duet with you one day. Maybe.
That would be fun. Let's do it.
Okay. And so
good
tell
night,
all your friends about it. Follow.
Thanks for having
us
on again. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. You're welcome. And follow the site. Share this with your friends. And subscribe on iTunes. And I love you all. And I want to thank you for being in Madam Perry's Salon.
Good night.
I'm sorry. Sometimes you just have to do these things. Okay. Good night, everybody.
Thanks again and good night.
All
off
right.
To the
thanks
burrito.
Again.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to end with Hugh Cornwell.
I'm sure.
Hot Cat of a Tin Roof.